Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. The much-awaited decision on Guantanamo Bay detainees did not emerge from the Supreme Court today. Court watchers are counting the days left in this year's session, which ends July 3rd. But the justices did agree today to hear a case involving global warming, and they released two important rulings, one striking down a Vermont campaign finance law, which limited campaign contributions to as little as $200, and one upholding a Kansas death penalty law. In the words of a dissenting justice, the court sided with the thinking, if a jury is on the fence about the death penalty, execute anyway. Well, joining us on the line is Professor Jonathan Turley, a constitutional law expert who teaches at George Washington University. And Jonathan, let's start with that Kansas case first, a serious case. It involved a man who was found guilty of murdering a woman and her infant. But this case just regards the sentencing phase, and the court's decision presents a new word for some of us. Equipoise. What does that word mean?
Well, equipoise generally means when all things are equal. And the general assumption has been that when it comes to the death penalty, you need a fairly overwhelming case to justify the ultimate penalty. And that certainly was the suggestion the court gave when it first struck down all the death penalty statutes. Many years ago, that they wanted this to be the most heinous types of cases. Mm-hmm. Now, here you've got a state statute that says, look, if it's an equipoise, if the aggravating and mitigating factors break about even, go ahead and execute. And what the court decided was that that's not a violation of the Eighth Amendment, which took many people by surprise. I was not as surprised because of the person that broke the tie, Sam Alito. This is a justice who many of us noted when he was before the Senate, who has a pretty extreme record when it comes to criminal cases, and particularly in voting for the government. And Alito has really shown in this term, particularly in this case, that he is absolutely, as many of us believed, reliable, that he votes with the government. And on issues like death penalty, he's pretty much in the pocket.
Well, also, so let's review. So the state of Kansas has written its death penalty law in a very specific way. As you said, it tilts towards execution if a jury feels that the evidence on both sides is equal. So this jury obviously felt, well, gee, both sides presented a pretty good case. We don't know what to decide. And the state law says then you have to decide for the death penalty. But the dissenting justices seemed pretty passionate. As we said, during arguments, David Souter made that comment about, well, this just means if a jury's on the fence, then execute. In the dissenting argument, he wrote the decision was morally absurd. What is this case and the papers that are being written reveal about the court?
Well, first of all, it's important to remember that we're talking about the penalty phase, that the guilt may not be a close question, but when it came to the penalty, the jury in these cases found that it was indeed on the fence, that there were many reasons, at least as many reasons, not to impose the death penalty as there were to impose the death penalty.
Even though they found him guilty. Yeah, you're right.
That's right. And so what the dissenting justices are saying is that it puts a thumb on the scale, that in the past the court has always treated capital punishment cases differently, that under the Eighth Amendment and under general notions of morality, they wanted these cases reserved for those that are truly heinous, those where all of these facts are considered, where the death penalty was the only appropriate penalty. Here, you're talking now about cases where even the state law itself admits are in equipoise, are equal, where there's as many good reasons not to as there are to execute someone. So it's a significant sea change in terms of how we view the death penalty. Now, it's consistent with the view of many of these justices that they just want the states to handle this. But when you look at it over the last few decades, we have really come to the point now that the Supreme Court has such a minimal role when it comes to that sentencing decision that the Eighth Amendment has almost been pulled out of the equation.
So you're saying it's, also a state's rights decision as well as a death penalty decision. But that becomes interesting because we now turn to the Vermont campaign finance case, the other ruling today. Now, Vermont's law regulating campaign limits was considered the strictest in the nation, but the Supreme Court struck down the Vermont law, which seemed to be not a state's rights decision.
Well, I suppose the good news for state's rights is that you can execute the politicians in Vermont, but you cannot restrict how much they get and how much they spend. Now, that's overdoing it. But what the Vermont law was a really significant state effort to try to clean up politics. And I have to say, I was somewhat surprised when I read the law. When this was first accepted, I mean, it reduced contributions down to like $200. It reduced both spending of the candidates and what people could give. It even regulated how much you could spend in gas. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And so it wasn't as much of a surprise for some of us that the court said, this is too far. But what I think is interesting is the language of the opinion. First of all, this thing just fractured. You had six separate opinions. And it's clear that many of the justices have never liked the really important case in this area, which is the Buckley v. Vallejo case in 1976. And in that case, the court made a distinction between restricting contributions and restricting what a candidate could spend. And a lot of people found that sort of arbitrary. They didn't quite understand why contributions might be treated differently than spending. And this court seems to be moving in that direction of those critics and saying that restrictions on contributions as well as spending both have First Amendment implications. The other issue about this opinion that's interesting is it does take a more expansive view of what restricts free speech. And many of these justices, as you note, may have contradictory opinions in that sense.
Well, we want to hear more about that perhaps at another time as we get into the actual campaigns. But I want to ask you before we let you go. The Supreme Court also today decided to hear a global warming case. Now, this involves several states which want the Bush administration to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. Were you surprised by that?
I was a little bit surprised. I'm not too sure how to read it, quite frankly. You have both John Roberts and Sam Alito, who are viewed as pretty anti-environmental and very pro-government. And so there is a suspicion that the new majority, the really hard right majority that's formed, may be taking some of these cases to rule with the government and set some new law in favor of the government. But it also is something that's something of an embarrassment for the Bush administration, because here you've got states, including states that voted for Bush, who have taken the extraordinary step of going to court. Many of them have gone even further. They've tried to create their own laws to try to deal with global warming, because the president, as you know, it's like the last guy in the country that's convinced that there's still some question about it.
Well, we were saying today in the office, Jonathan, that when Parade magazine, which comes out on Sunday, makes its cover story, how global warming is affecting you now, it has definitely hit the mainstream, and this is going to be an interesting case to follow. Jonathan Turley, a professor of law at George Washington University, weighing in on today's Supreme Court decisions. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Jonathan.
It's always a pleasure.
Well, the justices must have had to road into work today. The Department of Justice building and the Internal Revenue Service headquarters are closed because of flooding and electrical problems caused by a weekend of torrential rainfall in the D.C. area. The flooding disrupted the morning commute, and a mudslide closed a portion of the Capitol Beltway for several hours. On Capitol Hill, the House and Senate are in session as lawmakers wind down toward the summer break. So we turn now to Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor for a preview of the week ahead, and she joins us from her home, where you are bailing out?
Bailing out is an optimistic way to describe it. I would say sinking into the mud.
Well, our listeners out west don't want to hear it because they don't have enough rain, but as you bail, let's look at the issues. Immigration reform. Gail, it looked like it was dead last week, but these lawmakers are heading home for the summer, and they're going to take a lot of heat on this issue. Do you think that's why there might be, as you write today, a compromise possible?
Well, we are right now in primary season. In primary season, with turnouts very low, intense groups can make a huge difference. But by the time we hit the general election, I think the complexion of the issue could change a little bit, and that's what I'm sensing as I talk to lawmakers.
What is the possible compromise?
It would look something like this. Everyone agrees on border security, that everyone agrees that there's a need for better enforcement, and everyone agrees that the public doesn't trust the enforcement that's occurred to date. There's also a lot of support for some kind of guest worker program, either asking people that are or forcing people that are currently in the country illegally to leave the country long enough to change their status, or just dramatically increase the number of guest workers. This is something that's very important to the business community, another element of the Republican Party base. So as I listen to people talk about this issue, clearly they are stunned at how important this is turning up in primary elections.
Right. They were very surprised at some cases we've already talked about, some races we've already talked about, and there's a primary election tomorrow in Utah.
That's right, where this could be another big issue.
This is an incumbent Republican congressman being attacked for his support of President Bush's immigration reform, which, as we know, would provide that path to citizenship you've talked about.
That's right. But you're also seeing a lot more pressure from the business community to do something on the guest worker front, and movement both in the House and Senate to find something, a compromise that would address border security and something to do with guest workers.
Well, you know, you point out a disconnect. I mean, people are obviously angry. I mean, the mail against that Senate plan of a path to citizenship is running 400-1 in Congress.
That's right.
But on the other hand, as you write, polls show 85% of likely Republican voters say that they realize that 12 million immigrants can't be deported. So is the thinking on the part of lawmakers that it's just a matter of time, you know, that for people to accept a certain reality?
Well, I think they realize that government, especially after the immigration reform in 86, which was, you know, promised to end illegal immigration and really enforce the law, absolutely didn't do that. Lawmakers realize they have a credibility gap with their voters that's enormous, and that they have to do things to address that. And I think the summer, yes, it could be a way of delaying the bill for the whole year, but it could also bring out some issues. The business community is trying to mobilize their supporters at these rallies as well to talk about what would happen to the economy if the supply of labor was cut off. Mm. So I think it's an important issue. It's a critical issue for the future of the country. More debate is probably very useful thing. Whether they can pull it all together by this year is still not clear.
Gail Shattuck, we've got about a minute left. I just want to touch on the issue of domestic spying signals that the Bush administration might consider oversight of the president's warrantless wiretapping program, which, as you know, has been fiercely criticized. What's your expectation? Will there be some sort of new oversight?
I never underestimate Arlen Specter, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for whom this is absolutely a critical issue. He feels that the president's claiming a right to bypass a congressional law as important as that 1978 law on spying, foreign spying, is just a kick in the head at the Congress, which he will not tolerate. He's simply not giving up on it. We've written so many stories saying that this issue is effectively dead, that the president trumped the Congress, that it does not surprise me that it keeps coming back, and will, until it's settled.
Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor and checking in from her waterlogged home in Washington, D.C. Gail, thanks so much for speaking with us, and take care.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll check the Eagle Cam. Much more ahead here and now. Here and now. Well, it's also the summer doldrums. We need a break from all the news, and The Sopranos are in reruns. What to do? Well, time to watch the Eagle Cam, one camera focused on one bald eagle nest in a white pine tree in Hancock County, Maine. Apparently, according to the Boston Globe, thousands of people around the country and in other parts of the world are watching. They saw three baby bald eagles hatch in March, and then they watched in horror as... Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Joining us on the line is Mark McCullough, endangered species biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's one of the scientists lending his expertise to the blog that accompanies the Eagle Cam. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Robin.
And we have the site online right now, and we see there are two eaglets in the nest. And by the way, let's tell our listeners how to get there. You can go to our website, here-now.org, or to briloon.org, if I got that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and you'll see there are two. Three were born in March. Let's address the dramatic moment when, as thousands watched, the Eagle Cam actually rivaled the Sopranos. One of the eaglets killed one of the others?
Yeah, we had an event of siblicide. It was the oldest eagle eating the youngest chick, which was unfortunate, but it does happen in nature.
I mean, people were horrified writing in and asking what had gone on. What did go on?
Well, rarely bald eagles will have triplets. Usually, at most, they'll have two eaglets in the nest. And the eggs hatch at about a 3 to 4 day interval. So, in this case, the oldest eagle can be quite larger than the youngest. And sometimes they get into fights with each other. In this case, the oldest eagle killed the youngest and I think eventually consumed it.
Right. And it points out that when you put a live camera on nature, it isn't always pretty. And we're watching, as we said right now, and by the way, you can watch either a video or you can watch an image that's on 15-second delay. Now, earlier, we spoke to you earlier today, and there was one eaglet out on a limb, so to speak. I see now they're moving around the edge of the nest. Where's Mom and Dad?
Well, Mom and Dad are probably within a mile of the nest. They may even be in the top of this nest tree. For the last couple of weeks, as these eaglets get older, Mom and Dad are not seen as often other than when they arrive at the nest and deliver food. So they're nearby.
Oh, boy. The one that's hopping around quite a bit, is that, by the way, the one that some viewers have named Big?
Yeah, that's Big, and it's lunch hour, and he's just finishing up a fish that he found left in the nest, and he just pooped over the side of the nest.
Well, thank you for sharing. Well, better a fish than, you know, his remaining sibling. Big is the one, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to tell because they're not, in relation to anything. How big are they?
Well, they're getting almost to be full size. A full-size female eagle will weigh between 12 to 14 pounds. We're not sure whether these eagles are males or females, but they're getting close to the size of their parents.
Yeah. And so what do we look for, in the coming weeks?
Well, the oldest eaglet was born April 10th, or that's when it was hatched out of the egg. And it's approaching the age now where it's starting to exercise its wings. As you mentioned earlier, they both regularly go out onto limbs adjacent to the nest and hold on tight and flap their wings vigorously. This is building up their strength.
Mm-hmm.
And probably within a week to 10 days, they will make their first flight away from the nest.
Wow. And again, a warning to viewers, because while that could be glorious, that could also be disastrous.
Yeah. As part of my doctoral research here in Maine years ago, I watched eagles making their first flight, and sometimes they would crash into the water and have to swim to shore, or more often they'd try to land on a branch and they'd just go over head first and hang upside down like a bat.
Well, one just seemed to do a little preening under his or her feathers. What does this provide you? Obviously, it provides people sitting at their computers hours of fascination. Although you ask that people only watch it 2-minute sessions because there've been so many people trying to stream the video. But what does this do for scientists?
Well, what it does for us is a couple things. It's given us some interesting insights into the early nesting behavior of eagles. Scientists generally stay away from eagle nests when they're laying their eggs and when the young are hatching because they're so susceptible to disturbance that they'll abandon their nests at that period of time. So this gave us a real unique insight into some of that early nest building behavior, and watching the female lay eggs and the incubation is shared by both the male and the female. So those are things that I'd never seen in 25 years of studying eagles.
Now I should say they're both sort of huddled together in a corner of the nest, if a round nest can have a corner. And we should say, too, there's a lot of other webcams. There's one in Massachusetts. The Northeast Utilities has one on a bald eagle's nest, one in Washington State. They also have bat cams, seal cams, where you can watch nature at work. Do you ever worry about being intrusive?
Not usually. These webcams are pretty safe. We've never seen that they create disturbance for these species of wildlife. We were really cautious about putting one of these up in Maine at an eagle nest, but we put the camera up back in January, long before the eagles were even thinking about nesting this spring.
Mm. And boy, I tell you, Mark, this has sort of been like watching paint dry. But I'm kind of glad, given, you know, some of the things that can happen. You know, part of it is the anticipation that they're going to fly any day now. What are some of the other things that you've seen?
Well, we've seen a lot of prey deliveries. When the male or female will come back to the nest, they bring fish and they bring waterfowl, cormorants, to the nest for the young to feed on. At first, they would, of course, rip open the food and feed the young chicks morsel by morsel, but now they just come into the nest, drop off the food, and leave, and the young birds are learning now to feed and rip open a carcass on their own.
You know, I want to mention, Mark, earlier this year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service removed the bald eagle from the endangered species list. We just have a few seconds, but should we stop worrying about these birds, or...
No, we really shouldn't. Bald eagles still will require a lot of our care and attention into the future. Their habitats need to be protected, and we also need to be concerned about contaminants in our environment.
Mark McCullough on the Eagle Cam. He writes for the blog. To read his blog or see the camera, go to our website, here-now.org. Look, they've moved slightly.
They are moving slightly.
Mark, thanks so much.
Okay.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes
now. Marion Nessel, a professor of nutrition at New York University, is also a longtime food industry gadfly. Now she's focusing on the supermarket, trolling the aisles. Why are those aisles so long? To educate consumers. Her new book is called What to Eat, an aisle-by-aisle guide to savvy good choices and good eating. And Marion Nessel joins us from the Argo Network studios in New York. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Why are they so long? You make reference to that.
Well, you have to realize that although supermarkets perform a tremendous public service and you can do all that one-stop shopping, they really are a business after all, and they're not social service agencies. And rule number one of supermarkets is that the more products you look at, the more you buy. So the object of the game is to make those aisles long so you're exposed to as many products as you can possibly see.
And so many products. You write in this very large book to cover all of this, an astonishing 320,000 edible products are for sale in the U.S., and the average supermarket might display as many as 40,000?
Yeah, at least. A big supermarket.
In fact, you say there's too much food available in the U.S.
Well, that has to do with calories. The American food supply has 3,900 calories a day available for every man, woman, and child in the country, and that's roughly twice average need. That 3,900 is what's produced in the country, less exports, plus imports, and it's not really what people are eating. It's just what's available. And if you're a food company, you either have to get people to eat your food instead of somebody else's, or you have to get people to eat more in general. And it's not that food companies are sitting around a table saying, how can we make Americans fat? They're sitting around a table saying, how on earth are we going to sell our product in the middle of this marketplace in which there's so many products to compete with?
Well, let's talk about some of the ways that they do sell that product. As you write, supermarkets, they're businesses, they're set up to maximize food sales. You recommend, for instance, if people are, you know, are trying to cut back and trying to eat better, just stay on the edges. What do you mean by that?
Well, stay on the perimeter of the store because all supermarkets are pretty much arranged the same way. The fresh foods, the foods that you have to take home and cook, are invariably on the perimeter. And that's for two reasons. One, because you have to walk to get there so you see products. And the other is because it's easier to stock.
Within the body, then, of the supermarkets are the more processed foods.
Yes, the minute you get into the center aisles, you're in processed food territory. And by processed, I mean foods that really don't resemble the original foods that they came from very much. They've had salt and sugar and fat added that make them overall less nutritious.
A couple of the points that you make about how food's sold, the high-cost foods are the ones that are at eye level. Supermarket products are to the right of brand-name products so that your eye will naturally travel right and see those as well. I mean, there's a lot of tricks to the trade.
There are, and there's also money involved because companies pay the markets in order to place their products on the shelves, and they pay more to place their products on shelves in attractive places. And the most attractive places where you're most likely to see them are at eye level in the ends of the aisles and at the cash registers. Expensive real estate.
You know, while we're talking about marketing, I just want to take a second and talk about the marketing to children, because you write in this book and also in the New England Journal of Medicine about the how the food industry is trying to expand its reach by marketing to kids. A lot of people have said that how much that contributes to the childhood obesity problem, but you go so far as to say that marketers are undermining parenting. How so?
Well, if a marketer is marketing a specific food to your kid and you're not aware of that marketing, you only see it when your child is having a tantrum in a supermarket or is pestering you like mad to buy something. And what troubles me about it is that it's deliberate. It's deliberately trying to get kids to do three things. One, recognize brands. Two, pester their parents for those brands. And three, come to believe that foods with cartoons on them that come in packages that have toys that are in funny shapes and colors are what they're supposed to be eating, not those boring foods that their parents are eating.
Right.
And so in that sense, it undermines parental authority around food because it convinces kids that they know more about what they're supposed to eat than their parents do.
Right. It's like the in-joke between them and their friends, you know, the marketers of a cereal.
Exactly.
Right. How far would you go? I mean, you talk a lot about SpongeBob and how, you know, he's used to sell to kids. Would you ban cartoon characters?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you see a cartoon character on a food, you know that that food is being marketed directly to your children. And I don't think marketers should be doing that. So my extreme position is marketers shouldn't be marketing to kids at all.
Well, not anything. But tell us more about that, because, you know, why? What? Tell us about some of the things that do get marketed. For instance, you talk about juices. As you write, they have sugars, but they've got nutrients as well. But what about juice drinks?
Juice drinks usually have less juice and more sugar water. I mean, they're basically a soft drink in disguise.
You call them liquid candy.
Well, they are. They have enough sugars in them and not enough nutrients to qualify as anything other than candy. And I think once you start thinking about soft drinks as candy and sugared cereals as low-fat cookies, you begin to question whether those are really the right things to give your kids for breakfast or even lunch.
How do you keep kids from, you know, they're so assaulted with the advertising, the candy's right at their eye level. You know, they now have these candy-free aisles, you know, the checkout aisles. But how do you keep kids from, you know, thinking that that box of cocoa, whatever it is their friend?
Well, first of all, you teach them how to cook. So you teach them what real foods taste like. You teach them where food comes from and what the food system is about. You teach them critical thinking so they can recognize an advertisement when they see one, and you don't have those foods in the house.
Yeah. Well, back to foods for everybody. I love your suggestion that fast food places in particular, there'd be a push towards half portions, you know, that you can pay less and, you know, get less. But that goes back to, you know, you're thinking that where places make their money is when you pay more for a lot.
Well, you pay more for a lot because the cost of basic food ingredients is low compared to the labor and the advertising and the packaging and the other things that go with it. And that has to do with federal policies about food. Our federal policies were set up so that food would be very cheap, and cheap food, it's hard to argue against cheap food. We actually have the cheapest food supply in the world. But cheap food these days has a health price, and that is one of the things that encourages people to eat more is when the food doesn't cost very much. And so it encourages marketers to make bigger portions. We've now gotten used to bigger portions. And guess what? Bigger portions have more calories.
Right. Well, and also processed food has more calories and costs more. For example, you take a Yukon Gold potato. Now, the cost of this one potato goes from 79 cents per pound to...
And that's in New York City.
Okay, right. And then when it becomes a frozen potato wedge, it's $2.49 a pound. If it goes to a potato chip, it's $4.77 a pound. If it becomes a gourmet potato chip, it's $10.21 a pound. So, as you illustrate, the more processed it is, the more profitable it is.
Yes, and that's called added value in the trade. And if you're in the food business, you want to add value so that you can charge more for it and charge a premium for it. And that puts enormous pressure on food companies to process foods.
That's author and professor of nutrition, Marion Nessel. Her new book has a lot of facts about food, including when you buy flavored yogurt, it usually has tons of sugar. So she says buy plain and add your own fruit, or eating the skin of chicken is as much fat as hamburger. You're listening to Here and Now. And Marion Nessel, let's turn to organic foods. More and more stores selling organic, including the big box chains, most notably Walmart. How do you know that the organic label really means organic?
Well, one of the things that I was really curious about when I started working on the research for What to Eat was whether you could trust the certified organic label. And I'm happy to say that you can. Every single person that I talked to who had anything to do with organic said that the certified organic really meant that the foods were grown without pesticides, fertilizers, antibiotics, hormones, and so forth. With that said, there are lots of problems about the rules. One is loopholes, where there are substances allowed in organic food that a lot of people don't think should be there. And the other is endless, relentless pressure on the Department of Agriculture and on Congress to make the rules weaker. So organics are just mired in politics these days, and I think require eternal vigilance to protect.
And just to, a moment on that vigilance, because as you write, you're a nutritionist and you're exhausted trying to find out what certain things are. It's hard.
It's very hard. The most surprising thing about the research for this book was how complicated the issues are. It isn't just that you go into a store and pick something on the basis of nutrition or health. You also have to consider environmental issues, how animals are treated, whether hens are caged or not. Just go on and on with these issues. And to sort them all out required, well, in my case, it required a year of research.
I've got my book open to page 85, and it's a chapter or part of a chapter entitled The Hormone Debate. You have a label from Farmland Dairy Milk, a milk carton, and it says, no hormones added, no antibiotics. But if you follow the asterisk, you write, you find this on a side panel. Delicious 100% real milk produced from cows not treated with RBST or beta-lactam antibiotics. The FDA has found no significant difference for milk derived from RBST-treated cows and those not treated. So,
yeah.
And as you said,
then what do you do?
Right. On the one hand, they're warning you against it, and then on the other, they're saying, but there's no problem with it.
Well, that statement is required by the FDA, and that also is a result of politics. In 1994, when bovine growth hormone was first approved by the FDA, the FDA argued that because cows have hormones that are exactly the same as the genetically engineered ones, there's no difference between regular milk and milk from cows that have been treated with this hormone. So therefore, you can't say anything about it.
When, in fact, there are some people who feel they get way too many hormones through their food and they don't want,
they don't want any extra ones.
Right, right. So this is what we're up against, just going shopping. It's become so laden. What else have you noticed? I mean, sticking with supermarkets, what else have you noticed about the ways people shop in this sometimes overwhelming world?
These days, there's a huge trend towards trying to buy healthier food. One of the things I'm concerned about is the way health claims play into that, because so many packages in the supermarket now proclaim that if you eat this food, it will help you protect against heart disease, cancer, immune system disorders. If you think about it for a minute, you know that eating some kind of cereal isn't going to protect you against getting an immune system disorder. But these kinds of things sell food. And all of these kinds of claims that are on foods that make the foods a little bit healthier make people think that they're eating a health food and make everybody forget about calories.
Right. Marion Nessel, and by the way, your name is spelled, I think, ironically, Nestle.
No relation.
No relation. What's the one thing you'd want to see supermarkets do that would be better for Americans?
How about putting healthy foods in, or the healthiest foods in the places that get maximum attention?
Like where would that be?
At eye level, at the ends of the aisles, and at the cash registers. How about piles of carrots at the cash registers?
Not in our lifetime.
Oh, you never know.
Marion, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Mary Nessel's book is What to Eat, an aisle-by-aisle guide to savvy food choices and good eating. For more information, including her New England Journal of Medicine article, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, coming up, look what the wind blew in. Scott Simon's with us, and we'll have a talk with him about his reporting in a novel about Sarajevo. That's just ahead, Here and Now. Here and Now. And listeners to Scott Simon's Weekend Edition Saturday will remember Irena Milic, the 16-year-old pop culture-obsessed Bosnian teen Scott met during the siege of Sarajevo.
Help me. It's cold and I'm nowhere to sleep. There's some way you can tell me. Oh, think twice. It's just another day for you and me in paradise.
That real-life Irena, singing Phil Collins, became an inspiration for Irena Zarich, the main character in Scott's fictionalized novel about the Bosnian War, Pretty Birds. The novel describes the life of a Muslim-Serbian mixed family forced from their home by the ruthless ethnic cleansing campaign waged by Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic. Irena, her family, and their African gray parrot, Pretty Bird, become refugees in their own city, scavenging for food, burning furniture for firewood, using cigarettes for currency. Then 17-year-old Irena channels her rage. She trades in her basketball for a sniper's rifle. NPR's Scott Simon reported from Sarajevo during those 4 years when Serb forces cut off supplies to the city and trapped Bosnian Muslims inside with mortar and sniper fire of their own. His novel Pretty Birds is now out in paperback, and Scott Simon joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I'm not going to throw a bouquet at you because all the critics already have. It is.
You know, some review said I've been wasting my time as a journalist. And NPR's president for news came down and said, I want to congratulate you on that fine review in New York over the weekend. I want you to know I agree. You have been wasting your time as a journalist.
Well, I want to ask you about that. We want to talk more about this fiction that came out of your coverage of the war. But What could you say in fiction that you couldn't say in journalism?
I think it was less what you could say than the kind of impact or contours of the story could have. I think when a novel is well done, it reaches into people's lives in a way that nonfiction rarely does, or at least doesn't for any length of time. If a novel's well done, it puts characters in our mind that begin to accompany us, almost sit on our shoulder for the rest of our lives, you know, almost out of time and place.
Yeah.
So honestly, Sarajevo had moved me so deeply, I was hoping to try and find a form that had a little greater impact than
right.
nonfiction.
And you could also express some opinions, for instance, about the UN forces who were incapable of doing anything. They couldn't use their guns,
yeah.
And you could express more fully what that meant to the people there. But let's further explain. The Irena that you met in real life is not the was not a sniper.
No, she's not. The name is a tribute to her,
right.
And the ethnic circumstances of her family are the same.
Right, and she is a Bosnian Muslim.
Yeah,
and
with a Serbian father.
With a Serbian
mixed
father.
Mixed ethnic background.
So early in the book, the tension between Serbs and Muslims is exploding. Her family, the fictional family, packed to travel to grandma's house across town. And you paint a picture of this teenager torn between two worlds. She's packing her Esprit jeans, her gossip magazines with Madonna,
yeah.
who she loves, her copy of Le Petit Prince. Would you read to us that section
sure.
there? It's on page 30 where she's finishing her packing.
Yeah. Finally, she's a high school basketball player, by the way. Finally, she reached back to her bed table and plucked up a bottle of honey almond makeup, a roll of fire and ice lipstick, and a small glass bottle of deeply purple nail polish. As she pressed down these last small items, she remembered one more. She rolled back the drawer of her bedside table and picked up a row of 3 foil-wrapped condoms, which she pressed a little more carefully into the wrinkles of the magazine. She had begun to zip the bag closed when she caught sight of the threadbare old brown pokey bear whom she had shared her bed with since she was 3. She zipped the bag as far as it would go before ripping the red bow on pokey's neck. He would be born like a pasha to her grandmother's house.
Where they would find grandmother shot dead.
Yeah.
And this teenager with 1 foot in childhood still, within months is picking up a gun and she's become a sniper. She tell and this, by the way, is to fight back the Bosnian Muslims to fight back at the Serbian snipers who are just cutting down this cutoff.
Yeah. And the artillery even more significantly, right. Because of course the Serb paramilitary groups had all the heavy weapons that they'd gotten from the old Yugoslav National Army, and the Muslims didn't have any of that.
It's incredible to read her descent, if you will, into this world. But at the time when she starts, she tells her new boss. She's kind of a pacifist, to which he replies, so am I when the world permits.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about that, because you've spoken publicly about your different feelings about war. You are a Quaker, and yet did something happen at this time?
Yes, it did, because I think that I felt, as I might have if I were a Quaker who was alive in 1939, that I didn't see a pacifist resolution. That if the Muslims and mixed ethnic people of Sarajevo had resorted to some kind of pacifist defense, I think, as far as I'm concerned, all the best people would have been killed and all the worst people would have won out. Mm-hmm. Which I refuse to find a good solution for the world, even as it was morally correct and uniform. And I could see in a way in no other conflict that I'd covered had I thought that. The war and the fighting and the dying was any kind of improvement on peace. I thought any kind of peace should be preferable to that. But, you know, in Sarajevo, the Muslims couldn't even surrender. You know, they tried in places like Vukovar and obviously in Srebrenica, and after they surrendered, they were slaughtered. So that wasn't even an option.
Yeah. I'm wondering, too, in reading this really exquisite book, by the way, it's one of the first times I've really understood the conflict in reading it in fiction form. Slobodan Milosevic died in March of this year while in U.S. custody at The Hague. Last month, Montenegro voted for independence from Serbia, and we're reminded, of course, the Bosnian War you write about became the greater Balkans conflict, the Balkans wars. And as I said, Montenegro votes for independence from Serbia. Now Kosovo seeking its independence. Milosevic's dream of a greater Serbia ended with a much smaller Serbia carved into a rump state. And that's sort of the news. But the truth is that a lot of people have forgotten this. And you had, you know, invested so much in it. And Arena, the real Arena, I'm wondering, still there. Your thoughts about how people, you know, it's just too hard to sort of retain the story sometimes.
Sure it is. And in the news industry, obviously we're a part of it because we go on to something else. And, you know, when my wife and I went back to Sarajevo the first time I'd been there, since obviously it had been peaceful, first time there was electricity, water, that sort of thing, many old friends in Sarajevo would say, gee, we haven't seen any reporters.
Right.
And it's a shame because, of course, at great cost to the... I think we owe the people of Sarajevo something akin to the debt we owe Londoners of 1939 and 1940 for standing up against incivility and brutality and fascism, I don't mind saying, while the rest of the world, who should have known better and did know better, looked away. And they have, at great cost to themselves, a multi-ethnic democracy in that country now, which they fought and died for. I think we can forget how the rest of the world, the United States, Europe, the United Nations, wanted them to accept the ethnic division of their society. What a frightful thing. Imagine if we tried to do that here. Mm. What a hideous thing. And yet all the best minds in the world were saying, well, that's what you got to do. They refused to accept that. And today, they have a multi-ethnic democracy to show for it, and they have a world of respect for me.
And it should be supported, you're saying, more supported. In about the minute we have, how's Arena, the basketball-playing Madonna
She's fine. She's in Croatia. She's waiting for the book to come out there. She's more excited about the possibility of what we call further development in the film business than she ever is about a smelly old book. But she's fine, although she says to me, oh, Scott, my ass is not as good as it used to be. Can I say that on the air?
Yes, you
She's
just
a high
did.
School basketball player. I'm sorry she said that.
Right.
Another pleasure of writing novels is you get to do some language that you don't ordinarily have on the air in journalism.
Well, NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday host Scott Simon, his novel Pretty Birds, now out in paperback. Just a few seconds, Scott. The next book is about what?
It's actually set in Chicago. It's set in Chicago City Hall, a place you know I happen to love.
Yes, you do. Well, Scott, thank you so much for this and for turning fact into fiction and in many ways making it more understandable and even more compassionate, if that's possible, from Scott Simon. Thank you, Scott. Here Now, a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.